Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from Jeld-Wen. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on Jeld-Wen windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
In today's episode, we'll be discussing the monsters of Arkansas. Also, in this episode, we have a special co-host.
Good evening.
How are you?
I'm Kathy Harrison. I'm Tanner's mom. I hope you enjoyed the broadcast.
I hope you do too, guys. Thank you. Arkansas. It's from history.com. Part of the land acquired in the Louisiana Purchase, Arkansas became a separate territory in 1819 and achieved statehood in 1836. A slave state, Arkansas became the ninth state to secede from the Union and join the Confederate States of America. Today, Arkansas ranks 27th among the 50th states and area, but except for Louisiana and Hawaii, it is the smallest state west of the Mississippi River. Its neighbors are Missouri to the north, Tennessee and Mississippi to the east, Louisiana to the south, Texas to the southwest, and Oklahoma to the west. The name Arkansas was used by the early French explorers to refer to the Quapaw people, a prominent indigenous group in the area and to the river along which they settled. The term was likely a corruption of Arkansas, the word applied to the Quapaw by another local indigenous community, the Illinois. Little Rock, a state capital, is located in the central part of the state. In 1957, Little Rock Central High School became the focus of national attention when federal troops were deployed to the campus to enforce integration. Arkansas became a state on June 15, 1836. Its capital is Little Rock. As a population from a 2010 census of 2,950,908 people, it is 53,168 square miles. It's nicknamed the Natural State and the Land of Opportunity. Its motto is Regnat Populus, the people rule. Its state tree is the pine. State flower is the apple blossom. State bird is the mockingbird. String facts of Arkansas. Established by President Theodore Roosevelt in 1907, Wichita National Forest reigns as the oldest national forest in the South. The Wichita Mountains are unusual in that their ridges run east to west as opposed to north to south. Arkansas is home to a wide array of natural resources, including petroleum, natural gas, chromium, and silica stone. Throughout the 20th century, the state was responsible for providing roughly 90% of all domestic bauxite from which aluminum is made. Although it was not officially designated a national park until 1921, the territory now known as Hot Springs National Park was originally set aside by Congress as a U.S. government reservation in 1832, 40 years before Yellowstone National Park was established as the first national park. With an average temperature of 143 degrees Fahrenheit, the hot springs have been used for centuries as therapeutic baths. Following the Supreme Court ruling in Brown v. Board of Education of Topeka, which outlawed segregation in public education, Little Rock's Central High School became a battleground in the fight for civil rights when the Arkansas National Guard denied 9 African American students entry in 1957. Weeks later, on September 25th, the students attended their first full day of school under federal troop escort ordered by President Dwight Eisenhower. The Ozark National Forest covers 1.2 million acres and includes more than 500 species of trees and woody plants. Arkansas is the nation's leading producer of rice and poultry and grows nearly every crop produced in the United States, with the exception of citrus fruits. From 1874 to 1967, every Arkansas governor was a member of the Democratic Party. Okay. Arbor Springs Water Panther.
I'll read it.
Okay.
Is this the last one? Is it long?
Is that paragraph?
Huh?
What's that paragraph?
Heber Springs Water Panther. Perhaps the most overlooked monster legend in the natural state in the Heber Springs Water Panther, a weird cross between the Bigfoot and a puma, and the creature reportedly can breathe both on land and underwater. It is manlike, with a covering of fur, gives off a hellish scream when roaming the deep forest around Greer's Ferry Lake and the Little Red River. Like the others, the water panther. Like the others, the water panther has been seen in recent years. Perhaps fewer people are venturing through the woods and swamps at midnight in the 21st century, accounting for fewer sightings, and maybe high-tech video games and movies have obscured the legends and the folk tales of a few decades ago. One more thing. The man was found around a low fire alone. He sat with stillness as his eyes traced on the faint wisp of a smoke crawling out from under the wood. The two hikers approached with caution as the rising sunlight broke between the trees. The taller of the duo set down his pack and moved towards the thin figure with an open canteen. "Long night, friend," he asked. "Don't get too close," warned Flint. "I don't like the look in his eyes." Colt set the water beside the man. He made no motion in response. Unwashed, blonde hair, littered by gray streaks, sprouted from his head, with a gout face to match. "Ease off, Flint," Colt replied. "Hey, buddy, did you lose your pack or something?" The man continued to watch the cinders twirl. There was nothing resembling a campsite or supplies around the man, but he looked as if he had been there for days. The tatters of what once were jeans hung loosely around his hips, and his feet were bare and black as dirt. "What are you doing out here?" asked Flint. The man blinked. "He's lost it," assessed Flint. "Got a name?" He twitched. "Did you come out here with anyone?" With this man's eyes flickering out of the trance, he stood up and took a surprised step away from the hikers. "Friends, oh yes, they left." He started gathering twigs and branches around the campsite,
tossing them erratically into a pile near the embers. I don't want to leave just yet. It's better around the fire. You two can maybe go through, though. Good to know, Colt started. So you're just going to stay here? The man nodded. Indefinitely. He sat back on the ground. Well, buddy, you're about 30 miles from the closest city. If you're head back that way we came and follow the markers, you should hit the road eventually. You sure you're okay? The man gazed deep into the flames once more. Well, okay then, Colt laughed. They left the man with some water, the few snacks they could spare, and set back into the trail. We can call the rangers if we get some service up ahead, Colt assured Flint. I'd say he looks homeless, but this is too far removed from any city from him to just wander up. Who knows? Let's just get going. We wasted enough time on him as it is, grunted Flint. They were aiming to complete a section of the Orzo Highland Trail over the weekend. It was Colt's idea to get Flint's mind off things for a while. Cole had grown up in the area and invited Flint to come with him on his last remaining mile of the trail. It was October and the Ozarks, and the forest was in proper attire. Preparing for the cold slumber of winter, the land exerted the last of its strength of the year, foliage sporting vibrant orange, red, and yellow bursts and reached toward the horizon in all directions, and a crisp breeze nipped at the hikers' exposed hands and necks. The two moved in silence for miles, simply observing it all. "How's the bar doing?" asked Flint. "Hey now, Colt's Single Action Canteen is more than just a bar these days. Serving wings on Monday doesn't make you a restaurant. True, but having burgers and brats on Fridays and Saturdays has pushed us over the pesky threshold. You haven't changed a bit since college," Flint laughed. "Why would I want to? Steadily business up front, and I can't get a ticket driving drunk in my room in the back. Plenty to keep me busy between the two. I think I've made out pretty well for myself. Jealous you didn't invest in it with me while you had the chance?" Flint paused at that. "Maybe I should have," he conceded. I suppose I'll be spending more time there now myself. You've got a seat on permanent reservation there so long as it's my name on the front." "How sweet of you," replied Flint. "Ah, what the hell," cried Colt as he came to an abrupt halt. "What?" asked Flint. "The markers, man." Countless trail markers plates had been gathered on one tree in a strange twisted shape, swirling about the base of the tree's trunk. The mangled metal stretched up into the branches well over 20 feet, with no nails to hold them. They were gashed and pushed deep into the bark of the wood to hold their unnatural shape. The forest beyond the trees was as indiscernible as it was dense, and they knew the darkness of night was no more than an hour off. Attempting to forge a path any further would be more brave than wise. Colt ran his hand up the spirals in examination. Christ, these must be from a head. These must be from a head for miles. Who the hell would do this? Said Flint. No idea, but those must be from every tree in this section, replied Colt. Best we turn around, concluded Flint. But the trip, started Colt. Can wait another weekend, finished Flint. I appreciate what you were trying to do, but it can't wait. Last thing in the world I need right now is to get lost in the middle of God knows where. Well, shit, I bet it was the crazy back at the campsite, mumbled Colt as they turned around on the trail. They saw not a single tracker as they backtracked, however, and only through steady consultation with their map's record of physical landmarks were able to find the area where they first found the man. He was still there, and the fire was now roaring. Oh, great, began Colt as they approached. Let's just get a couple of hours' rest each and head out at dawn, said Flint. And if he tries anything weird, I have a knife in my bag big enough to skewer him. The two came up beside the fire without another word between them. The sun was well below the horizon. By the time they unloaded their packs, but they made basic camp within the faded light all the same. Settled in as best they could, they sat opposite the stranger around the fire. Colt puffed a cigar as if he had all the time in the world to do so, but Flint kept his eyes on the man. The man stared at nothing but the fire. A distant but horrified cry rang out through the cold night air. Colt dropped his cigar on himself as he covered his ears. Flint moved to protect his own. The fire flashed blue for a moment, and the man howled with laughter. As the painful sound subsided, the men gathered themselves. Flint retrieved his knife, and Colt went to the edge of the fire's light to inspect the darkness beyond. What the hell was that? Yelled Flint. Too loud to be coyotes, reasoned Colt. Maybe a bear. Howler stated the man. The two turned to him, and his eyes darted to meet their own for a moment. Get out of here with that crap, scoffed Colt. What's a howler? Asked Flint. Christ, I haven't heard of that one since Boy Scouts. Same as Bigfoot, El Chapacabra, and all the mumbo jumbos BS, Colt spat. Some beasts that roam the countryside by night, preying upon inept hikers if they wander too far from their fire. My grandpa used to tell us stories of the howlers driving men crazy and worse. Just a spooky story to tell kids so they behave. That ain't what we heard. Maybe some poor dying thing trapped out there. Howler, the man repeated. The men did what they could to ease themselves. Colt revealed a flask from within the inner vest pocket and passed it to his rattled friend. With shaky hands, he relit his own cigar. First only silence rang, but soon the liquid did its duty in luring conversation out of the men. This was a good idea, you know, Flint started. Thanks, man, responded Colt. After everything at home happened, I honestly couldn't tell who was my friend anymore. All the lawyers, the papers, the gossip, it was just too much for me. You know, I'm not good at any of that. Don't get in your head too much about it. Hard not to, man. It's just a rough patch. We all hit them. Go ahead and get some sleep. I'll stay awake and we can head out first thing in the morning. We'll be having a laugh over some cold brews by this time tomorrow. Flint went to his hammock with his knife still well in his hand. However, soon he found the soft crackle of the flame and the subtle swinging to be too alluring after a long day of hiking. The horrible cry was fading to little more than a distasteful memory as he drifted off into a sweet oasis of sleep. There was no reference to be found in rest, however, and within his dreams he found himself woefully alone in a mist-filled field, a filled forest. He walked. A low and deep growl filled the air behind him. He walked faster. Daring to turn his head behind him, he saw wisps of black fur. He ran. Ahead of him was a pale bone tip reflecting the moonlight. He sprinted to the other direction. The snap of a swift teeth rang out in response behind him. Then the floor behind him was no more, and he fell forward into nothing surrounded by sound not found in nature. He awoke, soaked in sweat, his hands grasping the hilt of the knife so tightly that his knuckles were white and arched deep. Coat was gone, but the man was not. Gusts of wind rustled the dead leaves below his hammock. But otherwise, the night was quiet. Flint struggled to free himself from his hammock. He paced around the fire and called for Colt. He looked at the man in the fire and back towards the night. Shuddering the silence came a sound more terrible than the last tenfold. Guttural and so deep, the branches of the trees themselves trembled. The howl was loud, beyond reason. The fire grew well beyond its pit and sent fragments of blue flames dancing between the stars before being silenced by the immutable darkness. Flint fell to his knees and clutched his head in agony while the howl echoed off the forest for what felt like a harsh eternity. After it dwindled down, Flint rose up from the ground. Bewildered by the night, he took a seat across from the unmoved man while his head spun. At daybreak, he set out in search for his friend. Unfamiliar with the area, he carved his own markers with his knife as he searched. His calls into the forest went unanswered, and the hours passed without concern for his plight. He heard the howl the whole way, yet no matter how hard the search, he found neither the source or his friend all afternoon. Near nightfall, miles away and well off the trail, he found Colt near a small stream, with his arms folded neatly across his chest. The blood in his ears were dried and flaked, but the trails running down his neck and face were still wet. His eyes were wide, frozen, and without life. In silent duty, Flint gathered him in his arms and returned to the camp as the sun began to distant once more. He found the man gathered wood, seeing the crumbled figure in Flint's arms. He shook his head and laughed. "You think this is funny?" Flint laid the long, skinny body in the light and went over towards the man. He continued to laugh. Shut the hell up, yelled Flint as he pushed the man over a rock. He laughed even louder as he hit the ground. Stop laughing, he commanded as he struck the man's jaw squarely with a closed fist. The man continued, so he hit him again, but harder. Blood with broken chips of teeth pooled in the back of the man's mouth, but he emitted gurgling laughter nevertheless. Flint struck him again and again with all his strength, to no avail. Eventually, he lost himself to the task of stopping the sound that assailed him so. With calm procession, Flint took out his knife and opened the man across the throat. Lacking for air, the laughter subsided. The last look in the man's eyes was almost gratitude. Immediately, Flint heard a cackle come from all around him, and so he sat close to the fire. As the darkness beyond grew, he saw by the flames light flashes of barred teeth and heard the scuffle of hoofs. When the fire grew low, he had no choice but to offer his remaining supplies in sacrifice to the light. The satiated fire spat back shadows for Flynn's wary eyes to follow. Three shades of human form were cast by the light. Two danced with one another while the other watched and clapped, and a smile almost cracked across Flint's dried lips. Spinning around the incandescent glow without a care, the smaller of the two began to fade. Soon it withered to a flicker and finally dissolved into nothing more than ash and dirt. The two that remained dredged together towards the forest, but one strayed too far from the flame. The tall became lost in the darkness beyond the light, and so was consumed with it. The lone shade now looked all about the light for the small or the tall, but they both were beyond sight. A shadow of a claw pursued the frantic form like a cat toying with a cornered mouse and attempted to wrap about the lone figure who clung desperately close to the dying fire. Clint finally removed his shirt and the shoes to feed the fire, and the darkness receded once more. Daybreak soon, but Flint dared not sleep even then. He had no supplies to speak of, nor idea where he was within the forest, and the two bodies beside him were now gathering flies and worse. He heard sounds both near and far of the horrid howl, other hikers approaching, and hundred others that blended together in a terrible
cacophony.
Eyes heavy as stone, yet refusing to close, they remained transfixed by the cruel blue flames.
Gonna read this.
Huh? The Aardvark howler, also known as Aardvark black howler, the hoo-hoo, the nightshade bear, and the devil cat is a legendary creature that is purported to live in remote areas in Arkansas, Missouri, Oklahoma, and Texas. It is typically described as being bear-sized, with a thick body, stocky legs, black shaggy hair, glowy red eyes, and prominent horns. Its cry is often described as being a combination of a wolf howl, an elk's bugle, and the laugh of a hyena. Cryptozoologists have suggested that the creature might be a misidentified or unrecognizable big cat. Anthropologists and folklorists have speculated that the creature might be a branching off of a dark dog of the death found in British folklore, such as a church grim, black shuck, or a gate trash. These comparison notes that many versions of the hellhound are described, like the Aardvark howler, as having glowy red eyes. The Aardvark howler also, like these legendary beasts, has been described as a dark omen, predicting the death of those who see it. Some biologists who believe in the Aardvark howler assert that it's a mountain lion breed who has either mutated into a new subspecies or is a hybrid of a mountain lion and is an unknown creature. Other guesses have included that the Aardvark howler might be a wild boar, an eastern woodland bison, a hyena, or a surviving member of the Creodont family. Hoax. Chad Arment asserts in his book, Cryptozoology, that the Aardvark howler myth is a hoax. According to Arment, he and many other cryptozoologists received an email message making claims about Aardvark howler evidence. These messages were tracked down to a University of Arkansas student who had made a bet that he could fool the cryptozoologist research community. However, stories of the Aardvark howler are said to predict that this Jason Offutt, in his new book, Chasing America Monsters, writes that many people have dismissed the Aardvark howler, but howler sightings stretch back to the early 1800s. Zorin Coleman had endorsed the book as highly recommended writing. Offutt does a special service to the field of cryptozoology with the new book. History of sightings. The earliest legend of the Aardvark howler is of meeting between the Daniel Boone and the creature in Missouri in the early 1800s. Boone is purported to have fired his gun at the Orzel collar in some version of the story. Although there is no evidence that the beast was killed and kept as a trophy. Recently, the Orzok Howler was in Newton County, Arkansas, 2011. Most recently, in 2015, an area resident claimed to have photographed the Orzok Howler at Devil's Den State Park. Orzok Howler in literature. Whatever the truth of the Orzok Howler is, or Orzok Howler, it has inspired generations of artists and writers. In the 1930s, a local press published a small run of books of folklore about the creature called Tales of the Orzok Howler. A destined later folklorist, Vince Randolph, referred to the Orzok Howler by the name Ho-Ho in the book. Orzok Superstitions. In 1973, the Orzok Howler was reimagined as a multi-dimensional time-traveling creature in Timothy Goodwin's short story, The Hair of the Black Howler. Most recently, the Howler has been written about in the children's books Hunt the Orzok Howler and Billy Bob's Howler, as well as the Mason-Dixon series of novels by Eric R. Asher. The Orzok Howler has also inspired regional poets, most notable in K.W. Perry's book, Orzok Howler and Orzok Howler Verse by Rufus Gray.
We all know real life can suck sometimes, and your boss accidentally seeing you in your underpants on Zoom last week doesn't help any. That's why reluctantly codependent sisters, the Shira and Rishalia, keep you enthralled and in stitches every week with their podcast, Legendary Africa. Every Monday and Friday, we take you on a journey of mythical lands, magical objects, and monstrous creatures, both ancient and modern. Find Legendary Africa on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and wherever you feed your ears. And remember, stay safe, stay sexy, and stay legendary.
The howl, as you might expect, is the hallmark of the Ozark Howler. Its sound has been described as a very deep and guttural, as well as high-pitched howl. Others have said that it's the most unearthly scream, half-human. One of the most common descriptions of the sound is like screams of a woman. Those who have heard the screams pierce the night never forget the chill that ran up their spine and the feeling of dread that washed over them. Some claim that the sounds are made by animals commonly found in the region. They point to the screams and howls of animals like the red fox, fisher cat, and even biting raccoons. Is it acusive? Scottish, Irish, Welsh, and English settlers homesteaded the Ozark Plateau in the mid to late 1800s, and they brought with them their ancestral stories and mythologies. One such story was the Cuthis, a mythological hound that is feared as a harbinger of death. The settlers believed that the hound would come to bear away the soul of a person to the afterlife, similar to the Grim Reaper. Hounds of death went by the other names such as Bean, Sith, Cusith, and Cwn Annw. According to the Scottish folklore, the Cusith is said to be the size of a young bull with the appearance of a wolf. Its fur is shaggy and usually cited as being dark green, though sometimes white. Its tail is described as being long and either coiled up or plaited. Or braided. Its paws are described as being the width of a man's hand. The Cusith is sought to make its home in the clefts of rocks in the highlands, and also to the roam the moors and highlands. According to legend, The creature was capable of hunting silently, but would occasionally let out three terrifying bays, and only three, that could be heard for miles by those listening for it, even far out at sea. Those who hear the baying of the Cusis must reach safety by the third bark or be overcome with terror to the point of death. It was also said that the baying was a warning to lock up nursing women lest the beast abduct them and take them to a burial mound, Scottish Gaelic, to supply milk for the children of the Fae. In Wales, they were associated with migrating geese, supposedly making because their honkings in the night is reminiscent of barking dogs. Hunting grounds for the Cuin Annwn are said to include the mountains of Cader Idris, where it is believed the howling of these huge dogs were told dead to anyone who heard them. According to Welsh folklore, their growling is loudest when they are at a distance, and as they draw nearer, it grows softer and softer. Their coming is generally seen as a death portent. Some people see a connection between the mythologies that came here with the settlers and ancient stories of the Native Americans who inhabit the region. Natives told stories of a saber-toothed tiger that used to roam the land, although they have been gone for thousands of years. Combining stories of the tiger and the settlers' tales of unworthy creatures that scream and carry the souls it did may have resulted in the Ozark Howler. Okay. The White River Monster. Since at least 1915, residents of Newport in far northeast Arkansas have been reporting signs of a fearsome river monster known locally as Whitey. In the muddy waters of the White River, the best early eyewitness account of the creature comes from July 1937 when a wealthy and respected plantation owner named Bramlett Bateman claimed he saw the monster in the river, describing the creature as having slick gray skin like a seal, blowing up great gouts of water from a blowhole, and being wide as a car and three cars long. That's in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 feet long. Bateman was convinced enough of the existence of the creature that he helped spearhead the construction of a huge rope net to span the river in an attempt to try and capture the beast. Former Navy divers were even brought in to look for the creature underwater, but to no avail, Whitey apparently disappeared until 1971 when witnesses along the White River again claimed to have seen a gray horned monster more than 20 feet long thrashing in the water. Investigators later found a trail of 14-inch long footprints, each with three toes along the riverbank, with some experts suggesting the monster might be a wayward manatee or elephant seal. Interest in the case was so fierce that in 1973, the Arkansas State Legislature planted firmly in their cheek, created the White River Monster Refuge, making it illegal to harass or harm the monster. Though the White River Monster is now a protected species, signs have dropped off precipitously in recent years. This is from AY Magazine, aymag.com, by Joe David Rice. About 250 miles northeast of the stomping grounds of the folk monster lies another favorite haunt of cryptozoologists. It's a stretch of the White River near Newport, and the quarry is an elusive beast aptly named the White River Monster. Although Native American lore is said to have passed down tales of a legendary phenomenon and other sightings a date from 1915, things didn't really get really interesting until the summer of 1937. That's when Dee and Sylvia Wyatt, a sharecropper couple living on the river, spotted what appeared to be a drowning horse thrashing in the middle of the stream. They kept quiet about it at first, fearful ridicule from the friends and family, but when the same commotion continued for several days, they finally contacted Bramble Bateman, their landlord and a son of a prominent family. After Bateman observed the strange creature churning the water, he hurried into Newport, reporting he had seen a beast in the White River, as big as a boxcar and slick as slimy as a slimy elephant without legs. A dozen or so other witnesses, including
a Jackson County deputy sheriff stepped up to corroborate the perplexing account. Although the location of the alleged sightings was about 6 miles north of Newport via an unpaved and overgrown road, hundreds of townsfolk swarmed the riverbank in the days to follow. Many left convinced that they spotted the aquatic invader. Newspaper articles from across the country included detailed descriptions of the monster, but press photographers never captured it on film. Time magazine, noting that 1937 had been a dull year for monsters, got an act running a 500-word piece on the peculiar happenings in Newport. Armed citizens, one toting a Thompson submachine gun, patrolling the shoreline 24 hours a day for a week before the Newport Chamber of Commerce partnered with Bateman and began charging spectators 25 cents a head. Then they hired Charles Brown, a professional diver from Memphis, to probe the river steps, carrying a razor-sharp 8-foot harpoon. Brown slipped beneath the surface 3 times over a 2-day period in search of the behemoth. Meanwhile, local entrepreneurs built a dance floor next to the river, brought in musicians, and sold barbecued goat sandwiches, fresh fruit, and cold drinks to the festive throng. Darren could even hire a pilot for a bird's eye view of the spectacle. Spectacle. After Brown found no evidence of anything unusual, not surprising given the murky water's 3-inch visibility, the carnival-like atmosphere soon dissipated. One expert estimated Newport had received $9 million worth of free publicity in 1937 as a result of the hoopla. Strangely enough, the White River monster story had overshadowed another search going on at the same time, the hunt for lost air trucks Amelia Earhart. In the summer of 1971, additional sightings of the White River monster occurred. One gentleman supposedly got a Polaroid photograph of the beast, but was too vague to be useful. Curious about these incidents, Ollie Richardson and Joey Dupree launched a boat into the river near Newport and headed for Townhead Island, a short distance upstream from the location of 1937 incidents, where bizarre tracks had been found in the sand. Their watercraft suddenly stuck something in the middle of the river, elevating the boat and terrifying the men who were convinced they landed on the back of the brute. The Richardson Dupree duo didn't see the monster, but other sightings that summer included one that claimed a horn emerged from the creature's forehead and another that reported it looked as if the thing was peeling all over, but it was a smooth type of skin or flesh. These observations convinced one imaginative biologist that a large male elephant seal in its annual molting stage had mistakenly traveled thousands of miles from points unknown across the Gulf of Mexico into the Mississippi River and up the White River to the Newport area. Fortunately, the Arkansas Senate found time to debate the matter, recognizing it was in the best interest of the state of Arkansas to protect the welfare of now internationally famous White River monster from harm or extinction. Because of the great tourist attraction, this august body passed a resolution in 1973 establishing a 48-mile riparian reserve to be known as the White River Monster Sanctuary and Refuge. Referring to periodic sightings by reputable persons, this non-binding resolution, sponsored by Senate Robert Harvey of nearby Swifton, made it unlawful to molest, kill, trample, or harm the White River Monster while in its natural retreat. No violations have yet been reported.
Folk?
Yeah, folk.
The folk monster. The state's most famous legendary creature, the folk monster, is named after Folk, a tiny town in Miller County in the far southwest of the state. Stories of a large hairy creature had been circulating in the area since at least the 1940s, But the legend really took off in May of 1971 after the folk resident Bobby Ford and his family raced into the town to report to the local police that previous night they and their home had been attacked by a hairy creature that stood 7 feet tall, stood upright like a man, and had bright red eyes. Ford's wife, Elizabeth, and Ford's brother said it all started after they saw the creature on their rural property and took a shot at it with their rifle, knocking it down and apparently wounding the creature. The Ford told deputies that the engaged creature then attacked the house, trying to break in through the windows and doors. And at one point of putting a long hairy arm through a window,
oh my God,
in an effort to grab one of them. After several hours under surge, the Fords were able to escape and to drive to town to report what they had seen. After Bobby Ford was treated for shock, bruising, and scratches at a local hospital, police investigators visited the property and found no monster blood or corpse, but did find huge, strong tracks and claws like gorgs on the porch of the house. Newspaper reports of the events the next day coined the name Folk Monster, and the story became a nationwide sensation after it was reported on the Associated Press, United Press International, Wire Services. The surge of interest led to the 1973 low-budget film, The Legend of the Boogie Creek, and a sequel which have since become cult favorites. As for the folk monster sightings in the area have slowed to a trickle in the years since the proposed attack on the Ford's home.
More often than not, a porter's life is anything but glamorous. Instead of unraveling mysteries, a lovesome paperback novel hero, most days are spent picking out bits of hard news, meetings, traffic accidents, buyers. Then for the very lucky, along comes a gem of a story. Jim Powell, Walter Porter, wrote the text Oregon Gazette and Daily News when he came across such a story in May 1971. He is now building manager of the Bi-State Justice Building. Dave Hall called me and said something strange was going on down in Folk, Bowles recalls. So we went down there. At the time, Hall was the news director of Texas Oregon radio station KTFS. He is now emergency management coordinator for Texas Arson and Bowie County. What Powell saw was a reporter's dream. It became an ongoing story that would eventually become a legend. The story was the sighting of the folk monster. When we got to the house, the people were moving out, Powell said. They had a U-Haul and were packing their things and leaving the area. Powell and Hall didn't see any tracks that day, but they did see a family that was literally scared out of their wits. We checked with the hospital and they said this. The guy was in shock, Powell. Said he was really afraid of something. In fact, Powell's story is the basis for much of what is known about the incident. The Bobby Ford family had moved into the house less than a week before. The men had been out hunting when they heard a woman scream at the house. Returning back to the house, Ford saw a creature that stood 7 feet tall and was 3 feet wide across the chest. and he felt a hairy arm around his neck. It scared him so badly that he ran through a glass and wood front door. The man said that they shot at the creature 7 times and thought they had at least wounded it. They told Powell they had used all their ammunition, but when investigators later came to the scene, no blood was found. But their fear was so real that night that folk constable Ernest Walraven loaned them a gun and ammunition in case the creature came back before morning. Powell said he researched the story thoroughly, finding printed sources for earlier sightings in the 1960s. It is possible that the story might have stayed a local legend, buried it on some back page and thrown out with the garbage at the end of the day, but something in the story sparked the public's imagination. The Associated Press and the United Press International both picked up the story and transmitted it to member newspapers across the nation. Maybe the story struck a chord because Powell liked the words of the people who had seen the creature tell the story. Maybe it was because he gave it an identity when he gave it a name. I was sitting at my typewriter on the second story and I realized that I had to call it something, he said. The woman had said it reached her hairy arm through the window. It was breathing hard and had eyes that were as big as half dollars and as red as coal. Powell dubbed the creature the folk monster. The name stuck. Hall recalled arriving at the scene early in the morning after attack to find a frightened family moving their blinds into a U-Haul. We went into the area behind the house and saw unusual footprints and small saplings broken off, heading to a wooden area, he said. We never saw any blood, although the people said they fired several shots and thought they hit it. There was a lot of speculation at the time about whether the science was an elaborate hoax. Rumors circulated that a circus train had derailed along the Sulphur River bottom years before, and the sightings were merely animals that had escaped and gone wild. This and other monster stories had a snowballing effect. Soon, teams of monster hunters descended on the city, and calls and letters from interested parties flooded local officials' phone lines and desks. My desk, too, Powell said. It got to be quite a showdown there. The local sheriff's office stopped people to check for guns and liquor and asked them to not cut fence lines. Monster hunters, fueled by rewards, swarmed across the countryside. The Little Rock radio station KAAY offered a reward of $1,090 to anyone who could find the monster. A local man by the name of Scoggins offered a $200 reward. It was chaos, Ricky Roberts, owner of the Monster Mart and Folk, remembers. There were a lot of people out there looking who weren't local. People showed up with everything from guns to tape recorders, hoping to catch a sight or sound of the creature. Giant footprints appeared in Willie E. Smith's soybean field. They were strange, Powell said. They were all in a line and didn't step on any plants. I got pictures of them. Although the creek hunters didn't capture the monster, the science continued. 3 weeks after the forward sightings, three people heading back to Texarkana from Shreveport saw something large and hairy run across the highway in front of them. I know those people, and they were very reliable and very truthful, former Sheriff Leslie Greer recalled. I don't know what they saw, but I do believe they saw something. An Oak Street resident sitting on her front porch said she saw the monster in a field across from her home. We had several here in town, Powell said. Then the science slacked off after the rest of the three hosters claimed they were attacked by the monster. I think they were drinking and got into a scuffle and skinned one another up, Greer said. They were fined $59 each for filing a fraudulent monster report. Greer, who was the Miller County Sheriff from 1967 to 1974, said he heard of the monster as early as 1946. I was campaigning for tax assessor and stopped to talk to a lady sitting on her front porch, he said. She lived about halfway between Folk and the Bellow Bridge. She told me that she saw some kind of animal go down in the field in a low bushy place. She said it looked kind of like a man and walked like a man, but she didn't think it was a man. Greer gave much consideration to the report until 1971 sightings. Then I got to thinking about it, he said. There were other reported monster attacks, but most turned out to be hoaxes. More worrisome was the fear that would-be monster hunters would harm some innocent person. There was a group who were going to get together a hunting party, and I told them it would be all right to come and look, but they couldn't trespass and they weren't allowed to carry any guns, Greer said. It hadn't hurt anything, and they didn't need to be carrying guns. Trespassing did create some hurt feelings, though. Word soon got out that Willie E. Smith, a local service station owner, found 3-toed tracks in his soybean fields and made a mold of the prints. He made souvenirs from the mold and sold them to monster enthusiasts. The original mold of the print stayed in the service station until it was destroyed by fire. Greer said he took the local game warden to the bean field, but neither he nor the game warden, Carl Galen, I never seen animal tracks like those in the field, and couldn't say the tracks were authentic. Interest eventually began to wane, but the coming of the movie, The Legend of Boggy Creek. 3 years later, Fairfield's story bring all the activity back to town. Powell covered that story too. Whether or not the folk monster exists or ever existed is a million-dollar question everyone in the small town ponder. I haven't seen it, but a lot of people have, and some of them are very credible, Robert said. I believe them. Folk Mayor Cecil Smith also has ambivalent feelings about the monster, and although he has seen the movie that scared millions, his only comment was that he thought the scenery was pretty. I used to coon hunt down there, he said. People would ask me if I was scared, but I never felt like anything that big could maneuver around. Some believe it's strong and some don't. But for Powell, the veracity of the story is no longer as significant as longevity. Its primary satisfaction comes from the lasting interest in the story itself. A living tale endures, like The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. At the time, it was a good story, he said. I've got a lot of fun with it through the years. I've gotten to talk to people from all over North America and get their views on the story. I don't have a lot of legends here, and it's interesting to be part of that legend. Every time Powell logs into a Bigfoot site on the internet, he's reminded of his contribution to the lore and legends that are kept alive there. That was from Sunny Theobato from Tuscarawas Gazette.
The Garo. The Arkansas monster with the most tenuous claim on reality. The fearsome Garo took root in the state's pantheon of monsters based on a single story that appeared in Arkansas Gazette PM January 1st, 1897. The story was a byline by reporter Albert Smithy, purported to be the account of a Little Rock businessman named William Miller, who said that while traveling on a business in the tiny town of Blanco in Searcy County, he had learned that a hideous monster called a Garo was killing livestock in the area. After forming a posse, Miller told the paper they tracked the Garo to a cave scattered with bones. There, they set up an ambush for the creature, but it got the drop on them by emerging from a nearby lake with a fearsome roar that caused the earth to tremble. In the account, Miller described the beast as 20 feet long with twin tusks, webbed feet, claws, horns along its spine, and whip-like tail with a sharp blade on the tip. In an ensuing battle with the posse, the creature reportedly killed several horses, uprooted trees, and tore a man's leg off before they were able to bring it down with sustained rifle fire. Miller claimed to have sent the creature's body to the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., but it never arrived. Since that account, the legend of the Garo has grown, including a witness who said he had encountered a Garo at Devil's Horn in Boone County. Like the original story, however, these accounts are littered with the hallmarks of fanciful Ozark folklore, and should probably be taken with a grain of salt. Maybe two. This one. Arkansas Garo. It's plenty to read, trust me. Arkansas Gauro is a giant lizard said to live in caves of Arkansas, Boone, and Searcy counties, northern Arkansas. It has two tusks on its head and is 20 feet in length. Makes an assortment of groans and hisses. Sometimes before 1935, E.J. Rhodes heard a commotion in a deep cavern called Devil's Hole, 3 miles northwest of Myrtle, Arkansas. He crawled down 200 feet to investigate, but couldn't see anything. Later, when he lowered a flat iron on a rope into the cavern, something bit through the rope. The Gauro, one of several fabulous monsters reported in Arkansas popular lore, may owe its origins more to naturalism than to traditional narrative and folk belief. The principal documentation of this creature's existence is a story that appeared in the Arkansas Gazette on January 31, 1897, probably written by Edward Smedley. Elmer Burris provided an illustration that was really based on a photograph to occupy the piece. Fred W. Alsep, who edited the Gazette at the time, recounted the circumstances that led to Smithy's story. William Miller, a Little Rock businessman, examination of the remains revealed a creature 20 feet in length with two tusks, large red feet, and in claws, a row of short horns along its back, and a long thin tail with a blade on the end. William claimed this as sent the body to a Smithsonian institution, but it never arrived at the Washington, D.C. Museum. Also dismissed the account. It was a great fake, probably, without foundation, in fact. The Ozark Research of Folklore collector Vance Randolph revealed additional details about the Gauro, which he believed had been reported as early as the 1880s. Randolph's sources suggested that the Gauro was a species of creature rather than an individual monstrosity. The unhatched from a soft-shelled eggs as large as beer kegs, and the mother carried nearly hatched infants in a pouch. Okay, some marsupial. Randolph related a story about an encounter with a Gauro by Spelunker exploring devil holes in Boone County. Also told of someone from Mena, Polk County, who claimed to have captured a Gauro by inducing the creature to eat so many dried apples that it swelled to a size that prevented it escaping into its burrow. The Gauro's captor was exhibiting its catch to anyone who would pay a quarter. Once he had sufficient audience, the man was staggered from behind the curtain with his clothes in rags and asked if the Gauro had escaped. This set the crowd into a panic without his having to produce an actual Gauro. Creatures such as the Gauro abound in the folklore exaggeration that's often associated with the frontier. Though sometimes stories about them may be told as true, more frequently they are tall tales or lies, as some tortures denominate them. In fact, Randolph presented his material on the Gauro in a collection of all tall tales entitled We Always Lie to Strangers. Okay. Thank you for listening to this episode of Monster Legend Podcast. In order to find more information about Monster Legend Podcast, go to monsterlegendpodcast.com or anchor.fm/monsterlegendpodcast. There you can find all episodes and platforms on which the podcast is on, which you can subscribe to. You also can email me with questions that will be answered on the show. Thank you.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.